The organizers, it's a great privilege to be able to present this work in this thought. And also let me thank my friend Roberto for coming up for this. This is work which is in progress. There is a book in progress, and it has evolved out of conversations that have been going on between Roberto and I and other people for some years. And you'll see that the themes interrelate nicely to many of the themes which have been discussed so far. We take our question to be, what is a law of nature, a law of physics on a cosmological scale? And we take this to be an interesting and important problem, and particularly what we mean by it, and this will have come out in discussions already, is can the paradigm we use for subsystems, which has worked so well in physics, which I'll be specifying in a little bit, be usefully extended to the whole universe? So that in some sense, cosmology is unproblematic. It's just an extension of what we already know how to do in physics. Or do we need novel approaches to explanation for cosmological questions? And we are motivated partly by philosophical longstanding considerations, and partly by, that's where we get to use these blackboards, by a number of persistent questions that arise over and over again in contemporary cosmology in different forms, which have a sense of urgency about them. Why these initial conditions and not other initial conditions? Why are the initial conditions so special? If our cosmological theory is like a theory of subsystems, it has a huge space of solutions, only one of which actually describes the universe. Isn't that bizarre? Isn't it bizarre to have what you think is a fundamental theory of the universe that has many solutions, only one of which corresponds to nature and the others of which are in some sense extraneous? And then more and more the focus of argument and discussion among physicists and cosmologists, why these laws of physics and not others, and an issue, why these parameters of laws of physics and not others, and an issue that came out in several of the talks Einstein made, and I'm pointing to what was on the screen here in Chris's talk, this audacious move to hypothesize that the universe is spatially closed so as to eliminate boundary conditions, but this, I think it's insufficiently emphasized the meaning of this move that Einstein made in 1917, because all prior theories, all prior uses of field equations have a requirement to specify boundary conditions which indicate that this situation modeled in the solutions of the equations are a subset of the universe, and they interact through boundary conditions with parts of the universe which are left out. Einstein's move really was the ambition to have a theory of a whole universe without the necessity of describing it subsystem by subsystem, and therefore to have boundary conditions. But when you make that move, then what is the topology of the universe? A bunch of other questions come in. These are just motivation. I know, Niyesh, you have proposals for all of these questions.
Was this because there is an Einstein proposed to close the universe? Was it because of philosophical motivation, or was it because
That's a beautiful question. Maybe Julian or somebody else in the room can answer it after. Okay. Now, our view is that to address these questions, it matters a great deal what one's supposition is concerning the nature of time. Our view is that you cannot usefully address these and like questions without coming clean about your suppositions of a number of questions, but time is the most important. For example, if you believe that the universe is fundamentally timeless, then you think that there is a property that systems of mathematics and the universe share, which is that they're both timeless, and therefore you can contemplate that a cosmological theory consists of a mapping between, an isomorphic mapping between the universe as a whole and some mathematical object living in some timeless universe of mathematical objects. And many people in the profession of theoretical physics see it that way. And we can call that the hypothesis that the universe is isomorphic to some mathematical system. this is not a talk where I want to argue for every statement made. I want to present some theses, and then hopefully the arguments will evolve after Roberto and I have spoken in the discussion. We take the point of view that time is real, that history is real, that the succession of present moments is real. This is one of two theses which we take as our starting points. This is a version of presentism, that everything that is real and true is real and true in a moment, which is one of a succession of moments. And from that point of view, there is a property that the real universe has that we assert is not shared by any mathematical object, which is simply the property that it is always some time, it is always some particular moment. And therefore, we deny that there is a mathematical object that is isomorphic to the history of the universe. The second thing we think it's...
Can we ask a question? What would it mean experimentally, empirically, what you just said?
One of the things it means is the belief that the future is open, but I was about to come to that. Okay. The second thing that one has to be very clear about is what we mean by the universe. And in order to shortcut and eliminate a lot of speculation and the tendency of cosmology to leak out into metaphysics and science fiction speculation, we assert that there is just one universe. It is causally closed. There are no copies of it. And again, not even in mathematics. There's no mathematical object which is isomorphic to the state or the history of the universe. Okay. So those are our starting points. And I'm going to use those just to sketch how we approach this question, because we approach it in a particular way.
It's not emergent. It's not slow, like quantum mechanics. That's what you're trying to argue.
Even more than quantum mechanics, as I'll come to in a minute. But at least as real as in, that is, you get to write your grant applications saying that there is a Hamiltonian you're studying, at least. Okay. Now, we want to make a precise statement of what we mean by this question. And to do that, we have identified what we call the Newtonian paradigm for how in physics subsystems are described. And the idea is that one has two components of explanation. One has a space of states, which are assumed to be also the same thing as the space of possible experimental preparations of a subsystem or possible complete measurements of a subsystem. So there's this notion that you can abstract from many experiments on similarly prepared subsystems the possible space of states of that class of similarly prepared subsystems. And that is, quote, timeless, not in a transcendent sense, but just in the sense that it can be separated from the statement of what the evolution laws are. Okay. Then a law is simply a set of trajectories on the state space that is given an initial state and a certain amount of time, which we assume operationally is measured by a clock outside the subsystem. You can predict the later state. Okay. Now, the context, the operational context in which this is meaningful, to put it in terms which are consistent with the kind of presentism we have, is that what we do when we do science, and whether it's in the laboratory or in astronomy, as Julian was emphasizing, is we keep records of past observations. And those records of past observations are present in a present moment, and we hypothesize that a particular structure, a particular space of states, and a particular evolution laws are explanatory and well matched by the records of past data. So one doesn't have to believe to use this method that the laws are timeless in some transcendent sense. They just have to apply to usefully explicate or summarize the past, the data which is in the records of past observations. Okay, so I mean, there are many, many instances of this, not only in Newtonian dynamics, quantum mechanics, general relativity, as well as versions of computer science. This is a very common kind of system. And what we take as emblematic of it is the fact that you can give a complete explanation of what is going on in the subsystem to the approximation it's defined by separating the explanation into the choice of initial conditions and the choice and the action of the laws. Okay. Now, the specific question is this paradigm, is this method of explanation extendable to cosmology, which we take to be the study of the single entire universe? That we feel is the question at stake. Okay. It is certainly what people do, as has been emphasized, when you take general relativity, consider closed solutions, and try to understand or compare particular solutions of Einstein's equations with past data, with observational data. So it's certainly, this is roughly what the practice is in cosmology. Okay. So it's not as if it hasn't been tried and can't be tried. Our view is that what one is doing when one applies this paradigm to cosmology leaves one open to these and other unanswered and unanswerable questions. So it's a natural thing to do, but it's clearly explanatorily inadequate. It leaves necessarily, by the structure, lots of key questions unanswered, as well as the kind of questions that I raise in discussion, like how do you decide whether something is explained by initial conditions or laws. So our view is that there need to be new approaches to explanation and new methodologies of explanation. And I want to just make two remarks about that and then turn it over to Roberto. Okay. So one of them is that, as we've set the discussion up so far, it's entirely natural that laws can evolve. That is, a set of laws of physics, say the Standard Model, et cetera, might apply in one region of space and time and not in another. It's entirely within this description and this notion of what laws are restricted to subsystems. Furthermore, and this is a part of the argument there isn't time to give, okay, I would claim that new avenues of explanation open up. That is, some of these questions, like why these initial conditions, why are they so special, why these laws, can be very usefully attacked if you give yourself the flexibility for the notion that laws can evolve. And of course, to tie the things together, if laws evolve, then time is not emergent from laws. So that's why the principle of time being real is important. And that's why time could be even more real than in quantum mechanics with a fixed Hamiltonian. I'm almost at the end of my remarks. The second thing is, there certainly are proposals for laws or explanations that don't fit this paradigm. Some of them have already been mentioned. Another, for example, is Dirac's large number hypothesis, that there's a relationship between the ratio, say, of the size of an atom and the size of the universe and the number of particles in the universe. Okay, that we know is a good scientific idea because it led to testable predictions and it's been falsified. So there can be proposals for scientific explanations which are purely cosmological, that wouldn't make sense outside of a cosmological context, and which are testable. So there is certainly scope to invent new methods of attack, new kinds of laws in the cosmological context. So therefore, we believe it's our role to try to do so. And a last remark, of course, is that a question which emerges as soon as you open up to this and open up to the idea of laws possibly evolving is the issue of meta-laws, that is, are there laws which govern the evolution of laws? And we have some things to say about that, but we'll leave this right here and I'll turn it over to Roberto.
Sure.
Paul?
Just a couple of nuances here. So one is, with the time-dependent laws. So it could be that what you want is some way of expressing that as a function of time. But there's another way you can do it, which is allowing the laws to change as a function of the states of the world. And I took the liberty of adding 13 and 14. No, 12 and 13. So, it's hidden. Anyway, must we retain the fundamental dualism between the inevitable eternal universal laws and contingent time-dependent states? And must the asymmetry laws affect states for states do not affect laws be inevitable? So you could make it a function of the states rather than a function of time. One's implicit in the other, but it's a sort of subtle difference. And the other thing is that when we're talking about laws here, I assume that you're talking about something deeper than simply the fact that there are low-energy effective laws, which can clearly change with time as a result of change of the states. For example, when you have symmetry breaking, and then, you know what I'm talking about. So, yes. And I guess that's not what you mean. You mean at the level of some deeper Lagrangian or something.
Well, it's not clear that all the it's possible to assert correctly that all the laws that we have used so far in physics are of that, quote, shallower or effective kind, and then the question can be framed of, is there anything else?
Right. Okay. Is this on?
Yes.
Okay. Well, I too will speak briefly, but unlike Lee Smolin, I would rather take questions after my brief remarks rather than during them. My aim is to make explicit a set of interlocking and overlapping philosophical ideas that are implicit in the argument that Smolin has just summarized. My premise is that cosmology should not be viewed simply as a specialty alongside others, but that it has exemplary significance. The sense of our explanations of any part of the world is decisively fixed by our explanation of the whole. I divide my remarks into two parts. First, I present three ideas, and then I make a remark about the implications of these ideas for the past and future agenda of science and for the practice of natural philosophy. The three ideas are the following. The first idea is the idea of the singularity of the world. There is only one real world. The second idea is the idea of the reality of time, which suggests as a corollary the possibility that the laws of nature change. And the third idea is a quasi-empirical and deflationary conception of mathematics. Mathematics is about the world, but the world with time and phenomenal distinction sucked out of it. Now, each of the three ideas. First, the singularity of the world. There is one real world. And the most important fact about the world is that it is what it is and not something else. The sense of this idea can be defined by contrast to a metaphysical impulse that has gained strength in the recent evolution of physics and cosmology, namely the idea of a multiplicity of worlds, from the multiverse to the idea of the plurality of worlds. This impulse to multiply the worlds is associated with a particular problem, the appeal to laws that are compatible with many more worlds than the world that we in fact observe. The first and fundamental reason to resist this metaphysical impulse lies in the claim that if we attend to what science has actually done and discovered, rather than to what scientists say about what they have done and discovered, there is much better reason to believe in a succession of causally connected worlds than in a plurality of worlds causally unconnected to one another. The methodological reason to resist this metaphysical impulse is that it represents a break with the empirical discipline that has inspired the evolution of natural science for the last several centuries and threatens us with a regression to an allegorical style of science that modern science was born fighting against. The idea of the singularity of the world, however, generates a conundrum, which can be stated in both a generic and a specific form. The generic form of the conundrum can be summarized in Aristotle's maxim that the individual is ineffable. How can the singular world with a singular history become the object of law-like explanation? The specific form of the conundrum lies in the difficulty of generalizing to the whole of the world, of this one causally connected world, what Smolin has just called the Newtonian paradigm, with its distinction between a configuration space of law-governed phenomena and the initial conditions that bound this configuration space. There is no way to extrapolate this Newtonian paradigm to the whole of the universe, and yet this is the paradigm that has been the commanding model of scientific explanation over the last several centuries. The Newtonian paradigm is doubly subversive of the recognition of the reality of time. First, because within the configuration space, the results are foreordained in the causes. And second, because the observer, the theoretician, standing outside the configuration space, imagines himself in a timeless reality and has toward the phenomena the imagined relation of God to the world. The second philosophical idea is the idea of the reality of time. In stating this idea, I begin dogmatically with a provisional definition of time, the significance of which should become clearer later in my remarks. Time is the heterogeneity of change. The essence of time, the nature of time, is that some things change differently from other things. Time is the transformation of transformation. If everything in the world changed, but change itself did not change, time would not be completely real. Now, the claim of the reality of time, far from being a platitudinous remark, is a revolutionary proposition, incompatible with much of what we continue to believe. The physics of the 20th century undermined the idea of an invariant backdrop of space and time, and promoted this backdrop to a performing part in the world of the phenomena. In doing so, however, it reaffirmed the idea of an invariant, timeless backdrop of laws of nature. Now this same physics has set the stage for the idea that the universe has a history, and that at some early point in this history, the laws that we now believe to govern the phenomena did not govern them. So the idea of the history of the universe threatens to undermine the block view of the universe, of a timeless framework of natural laws outside universal history. And the multiplication of worlds in violation of the idea of the singularity of the world is the most striking response to this problem in the effort to save the appearances. The background to this dilemma in the history of ideas is a metaphysical and methodological prejudice. The prejudice that biology is a kind of weak physics, and historical science is a kind of weak biology. And therefore, the supposition that the understanding of history might be prior to the understanding of structure rather than subsequent to it seems to be a violation of the cardinal ambitions of modern science. The only way adequately to deal with this problem is to overturn this metaphysical and methodological prejudice and to give full prerogative to the idea of a historical science, as cosmology would have to be. Now, just as the idea of the singularity of the world generates the conundrum that I earlier described, so too the claim of the reality of time produces a contradiction or an antinomy of the following sort. If time is really real, if it goes all the way down, if it holds sway over everything, we are not entitled to believe that there is a timeless framework of natural laws. We must admit at least the possibility of the mutability of the laws of nature, that the laws of nature themselves have a history. And in fact, the seemingly arbitrary or at least unexplained value of many of the constants or parameters of nature might find an explanation in the earlier states of the universe and in the earlier content of the laws. But then the following dilemma arises. On the one hand, we might suppose that the transformation of the laws is itself law-governed. But then we simply push the problem up and once again confront the difficulty of establishing an exception to the rule of time. On the other hand, we might say that the transformation of the laws is not itself law-governed, but then it seems to be arbitrary. Among the possible solutions to this problem, there is the following one, which has to do with the nature of historical time. Namely, that the transformation of the laws might be coeval with the transformation of the phenomena. Now, this is not a nonsensical idea, although it is a puzzling one. It is, in fact, an idea that plays a prominent role already in the life sciences and an even more prominent role in historical analysis and social theory. We used to believe, when we believed in large theories of historical transformation, like Marxism, that the succession of social orders in history was governed by inexorable laws of historical transformation. Almost no one can believe that any longer. But the abandonment of the idea of these trans-historical laws does not drive us inevitably into an explanatory nihilism. We have learned in historical and social theory to work on the assumption that the transformation of the laws can be coeval with the transformation of the phenomena. Now, before going on to my third idea, I want to illustrate further the significance of the second idea, the idea of the reality of time, by suggesting its implications for two large problems, causality and possibility. Our conventional ideas about causation are clearly confused for reasons that are unrelated to Hume's canonical critique of our causal thinking. If time were not real, there would be no causation. The effects would be simultaneous with the causes, as the conclusions in mathematical or logical reasoning are simultaneous with the premises. But if time were really real, if it went all the way down and held sway over everything, then all our causal judgments would be afloat on a sea of changing laws. It seems that in our conventional thinking about causation, we equivocate. We believe that time is real, but not completely real. Now consider the idea of possibility. The conventional view of possibility is a spectral idea of the possible. The possible states of affairs are already predetermined. So on this spectral idea of possibility, the possibility is like a ghost stalking the world and waiting for its cue to come onto the stage of actuality. If, on the contrary, we insist on the reality of the one real world and on the radical reality of time, the possible is not this specter. The possible can only be defined retrospectively and not prospectively in the light of the successive historical transformations of the world. Now I come to my third idea, which is the view of mathematics that accompanies these two propositions. It is incompatible with the view that mathematics is simply a free form of conventional formulation, but also incompatible with the view that mathematics is a royal road to the perception of timeless reality. Mathematics, on this view, has all the properties that we acknowledge. It is powerful in explication, in a non-tautological form of synonymy. It is fertile in the production of equivalent propositions. And it deploys in the greatest power, recursive reasoning. But in addition to these three attributes, it has a fourth, which defines its specific and, one might even say, its visionary character. Mathematics is a visionary exploration of a simulacrum of the world, of a counterfeit vision of the world, bereft of time and of phenomenal distinction. In mathematics, there is no time, even though mathematics can be applied to time. There is simultaneity in principle among mathematical propositions, among premises and conclusions. And this intimate nature of mathematics always then subjects those who use it to two temptations. The temptation to suppose that through mathematics they will enjoy a shortcut to the inner nature of reality, and the temptation to believe that the world itself participates in the timeless character of mathematical propositions. Now I conclude with two remarks about the implications of these overlapping and interlocking ideas. For the past and future agenda of science, and for the practice of natural philosophy. So first, the agenda. This argument has two enemies. The basic enemy, the more important enemy, is the block view of the universe, which has accompanied the whole triumphant history of modern natural science, from Galileo and Newton to today, with its extrapolation of the Newtonian paradigm and its demotion of the reality of time. But the argument also has a secondary enemy. The secondary enemy is the attempt in contemporary science to paper over, to obfuscate the contradiction between the block view of the universe and the idea of a universal history, of a history of the universe. By appealing to laws that are compatible with many more worlds than the world that we in fact observe. So one way to understand the campaign conducted by this secondary enemy is this: that in its struggle to complete the evolution of modern science by a final unification of the structural laws, it finds a roadblock, an impediment. The impediment is the scandalous embarrassment of universal history. It wants to remove this roadblock by appealing to the idea of the possible worlds. And then it wants to hide from the explanatory failures of the possible worlds by a set of further ad hoc inventions, such as the strong anthropic principle, which should be understood as the 13th chime of a clock, which not only startles us, but casts doubt on the previous 12 chimes, and indeed on the clock itself. There is another intellectual possibility. The alternative intellectual possibility is to radicalize, rather than to qualify, what was most important in the history of modern science, namely attending to the one real world, rather than allowing science to lapse into allegory. To do so, however, to radicalize this most fertile element in the history of modern science, it is necessary to give up, rather than to defend, the block view of the universe. And finally, I make a remark about the implications of these ideas for the practice of natural philosophy. In natural philosophy, as understood and practiced in the period from Leibniz to Mach, was an intellectual activity that resisted the distinction between a discourse within science and a discourse about science, that took up foundational matters without having foundational pretenses, and that jumbled up in its intellectual practice the categories of normal and of revolutionary science. Now, this true and useful natural philosophy was followed in the 20th century, especially in the second half of the 20th century, by an entirely different philosophical enterprise in the form of the contemporary philosophy of science. Passive and respectful of the metaphysical gloss that scientists place on their own science, rather than subversive of this metaphysical misreading of the discoveries of contemporary science. The practicing scientists themselves, deprived of any established genre of natural science, conduct natural philosophy to the extent they conduct it at all, under disguise, in the form of popularized books, books of popular science. With respect to these books, it is clear that the exoteric audience is the educated public, and the esoteric audience are the other scientists. Addressed indirectly in the bastardized form of these popular books, as a result of the absence of a living practice of natural philosophy. Let us hope that the alliance of theoretical vision with empirical inquiry will defeat the allegories favored by the enemies of time, and renew the marriage of natural science to this one real and time-drenched world.
Shall we just throw it over? Kevin?
Yes, way back at the beginning of the talk, there was a reductio against the Bloch conception of the universe and an nice allusion to Boethius, I think, on God's perspective on the universe, which I think is apt. But I was wondering, is the problem there that the Bloch universe makes time unreal, or is it that the Bloch universe makes tense unreal from the point of view of God's timeless moment? Because, it seems to me that the reductio is tense. So tense is the grammatical marker of the directionality of time from the point of view of an agent who's situated in time. But time itself could be held to be distinct from tense, namely Boethius God and the God moment, which isn't ordered with respect to the physical moments, could certainly read off clock times, or he can talk about proper time in this sequence. He just can't say what's before or after him, but that's tense, right? It's not time, it's unreal form. So I was wondering if you could clarify what it is about time that's unreal as opposed to just tense being unreal.
No, but I was making a much more radical proposition, and that's why I define time as the transformation of transformation. So if everything changed, but changed in the same way, at the same pace, so to speak, time would either be unreal or less real than it is on this view. So the reality of time is a property of the world, not just a property of our experience in relation to the world on this view. That's what I take to be implicit in the claim that time is really real.
If I want to follow up on that,
Well, this relates to one of the things that I wanted to ask. I mean, I think I'm puzzled by it, similar thing to Kevin. I mean, so suppose we grant you this definition of time, this sort of meta-change definition of time. How do we get the distinctive, how do we get what we call presentism out of that? How do we get the fact that one moment is objectively privileged from God's point of view? Why can't we rewrite the whole story against the background in which there's no such
distinguished? No, I don't think that one moment is privileged. In what sense, privileged?
Well, presentism, at least as we philosophers understand, is thought of as the view that all that exists is the present moment. The future doesn't exist, the past doesn't
no,
exist.
No, I don't believe that.
Lee, can I ask you, what do you mean by the term presentism?
So we don't agree about certainly everything here. I think that there's no problem with that. I think on this regard, Roberto's view is more interesting than mine, but I'm happy to explicate mine. So mine is the assertion that there is always a privileged moment. That privileged moment moves or flows or emerges, etc. So my view is probably closer to Bergson than Roberto. That the becoming of the next moment out of the previous moment is a crucial aspect of nature, of reality. That from this point of view, the past and the future are very different. And for me, I'm very happy, look, I'm a physicist, I'm very happy to spy things around different ways. But for me, what's most exciting from this view and a departure from as a formerly naive, still very naive, but from things that I formerly believed, is the notion that the future is genuinely open. That is, you can draw the present moment allows you to draw a distinction between the past, which has occurred, about which there are facts of the matter. Not all those facts may be checkable or assertable, but there are facts about the past. Certain things did happen, certain things did not happen. There are, and this is kind of borrowed and deformed from Julian's views, there are time capsules or records in the present which allows one to make deductions about things that might have or probably did or must have occurred in the past. But the future is not yet real, the future has not yet occurred, and there is, because of the possibility that the laws are not fixed, among other things, there is the possibility of the future is not yet fixed, there's a genuine openness to the future. And there are several, I mean, the malleability of laws is one of the reasons that the future is open. And by this, I certainly do not mean that anything could happen, that I believe in miracles, that we could live forever, or that elephants could appear in the room. The scope for openness of the future is not large, but it is very much to be taken advantage of because it's not
so just to add to that, from my standpoint, from the standpoint of the argument that I summarized, the privileged character of the present moment is admissible only as a phenomenological claim, not as a scientific or ontological claim. It is a remark about our experience more than it is a remark about the world.
Would you say the same Contra Lee about the openness of the future? I mean, there are many people
including me, who subscribe to the block universe view, but nevertheless think that we can make sense of the idea of the open future as a feature of the kind of epistemic perspective that we have as creatures embedded in this block in a certain way, with a certain kind of epistemic access to it. Now, what you just said about the present moment sounded like something that I could accept. I could accept that there was a
sure. Kind
of,
sure.
The present in that sense.
Sure.
But would you say the same about the open future?
So I should go back a step and say a word about my motivations in this inquiry. So, as a social theorist, I am interested in a form of understanding of society and of history that refuses to explain the present arrangements in a manner that vindicates their naturalness and necessity. I do not believe that the recognition of the prerogatives of history condemns us to explanatory nihilism. Now, it could be that our experience of the human world is set within a larger natural universe that is arranged on principles fundamentally hostile to our interests. And one way in which it could be so arranged is if it were a Laplacian regime described under the block universe view. Because then the ultimate nature of reality would put the lie to our inner experience of life. Now, that could be true. But it would be much better if it were not true. And the question is whether the discoveries of modern science compel us to a conclusion that is subversive of our most fundamental human interest. My hope is that they do not. And this argument is in the service of that hope.
Okay, but I'm still not clear whether your view of the open future is quite the same as Lee.
Well, we don't know because we haven't discussed it enough. But it is central to this view that a common element of social history and natural history could be that the future is open and dangerous.
Okay, I have Julian, Sabina, Marcelo, and David. but not all at once.
I think my question is more or less answered, but let me just, would you allow me my image that I always take of snapshots, and we'll take that there's a notion of simultaneity. So is it allowed that we could at least imagine in your picture having snapshots of the past instance and looking at them all together? I think it's the assertion of both of you that from that you cannot predict the next one with any certainty, that there's genuine openness to the future. And when you speak about time being really real, and you talked about it being vindicated by the transformation of transformation, is it then the case that, so to speak, there are laws which somehow restrict things, but these laws are different? So as I go along, I've got my line of snapshots, and as I go along them, I say, there's a certain amount of law here and a certain amount of openness, and here those laws are different. Was that the way you meant
Julian,
it?
That's going too far, because
what
you just described is, for me, a metaphysical and a political hope, as I've just said. But I can't profess that I believe that what we have already discovered about the world justifies us in believing that hope is well-founded. The question is whether what we have already discovered about the world necessarily contradicts that hope. And my more modest claim is that it does not. So that my argument here in these summary remarks was not focused on developing the content of that metaphysical hope. It was focused on providing a general framework of a reading of the situation and of the discoveries of modern science that contradicts a reading that is now very established and very influential.
I mean, identifying the enemy as part of the...
Identifying the enemy and suggesting that we do what Einstein said we should do, which is to pay attention to science, to what science has done and discovered, and not to what scientists say it has done and discovered.
On the note of identifying the enemy, I have a rather naive question. What do you mean with real? From what it says on the blackboard, it seems to me everything that is real or true is true in a moment, and there are solutions that are not real. It seems to me real has something to do with it's observable. But when you say time is real, you seem to mean something completely different. So does it mean like basically the evolution is not deterministic, or there is a preferred slicing, or...
No, I don't get it together. I've said what it means. I think that if we unpack our conventional conceptions, I gave the two examples of causality and possibility.
I didn't understand that, to be honest.
Yes, we would. Well, take the example of causality, again. Causality presupposes time. If there's no time, there are no causal relations.
Well, one could probably say that, the order of cause and effect is kind of nonsensical if you have time reversal invariance, but I could have a block universe and I could have a notion of simultaneity, and I have no problem with something, one event having a causal relation to another event.
Well, there can be, if time is superficial or local, there can be local or superficial causation. But causation, if it is to be something different from logical or mathematical implication, must presuppose the reality of time in some sense. On the other hand, if time is so real that there are no laws of nature outside it, and that the laws of nature are themselves mutable, then the warrants of our causal judgments are all changing. So there are no timeless warrants of our causal judgments. Now, what seems to be the case is that our whole ordinary nomenclature and conceptions are in some twilight zone, in some middle area in which we equivocate. So we say time is real, but not completely real. It's only real up to a point. And one of the things I was trying to do in my statement of the second idea is to suggest what it would mean fully and radically to acknowledge the reality of time. It seems to me to be clearly incompatible with the assumption that there is a timeless framework of laws of nature.
Can I try and hear something? So first, just to your first point, yes, real was used in two different ways in those two things. But here's the key point. If there are eternal or timeless deterministic laws, then the property of any system or subsystem of the universe at any time can be translated into a statement about a property of initial time, using the inverse of the evolution rule on the configuration space. So to put it in a slightly different way, I think what Roberto means when he says if time is really, really real is the following. If there is a deterministic law of that form, then a description of the history of the world is possible in which time plays no role. That is, all the properties which are discussed are properties at a fixed initial time. Okay, what we want to deny is that possibility. Certainly in small subsystems of the universe, we do that all the time. It's a very useful thing. We're not denying that determinism on the scales in which it's been successful in physics is not useful, but when one goes to the scale of the universe as a whole and confronts these questions, the question is, there's a tension. Do you keep the belief that everything is inherent on timeless laws acting on initial conditions, in which case you run into an explanatory conundrum, that is, there are things, an explanatory failure, because there will always be very important things which are not explained. Why are the initial conditions so special? And if you deny the possibility that any observable in any future time is just a rearrangement of observables in initial times, then that's equivalent to the statement that there is not a one-to-one map from the observables at a later time to the observables in initial time, and that's equivalent to the statement that laws may hold over some finite intervals of time, but not the same laws moving for all intervals, etc.
Yeah,
but
and
it basically means it's not deterministic.
That is the question of are there laws by which, quote, are there meta laws by which the laws evolve? And maybe that's of course the deepest, most difficult issue about developing a whole view, but non-deterministic is equivalent to the statement that the future is open. Yes, it may be that if we knew everything that is possible to know about the present state of the universe, is not enough to know the future state.
The question about what it means to say that time is real has many partly equivalent formulations. One of them is to translate it into the question, how different is causal attribution from logical implication? Is it very different or only a little different?
Some equations, look, they're hyperbolic equations. They have a clear notion of the causal process. Not all equations do. The historical arguments for Mach and Russell ignored that difference. But you're just being this loose false distinctions as those guys were. They wrote before Hannibal, so they didn't pay attention to that.
But, many philosophers have believed that causal language could be and should be translated into logical language. That's a question about the world. Is the world like that or not?
But look, you were making some assertions. Let's just look at the equation of mathematical physics. If we demand, as they often, that's one of the senses of relativity, that they should be hyperbolic of some flavor and character, that doesn't still, and we do want to make notion of signal speed and that there being limits on that. And those are built into the equations. Those are an important part of the content of the theory that doesn't have. Who cares what the philosophers think about causation?
No, but I agree with you. Who cares about what the philosophers think? So the question is, what is the world like?
I can
myself.
Yeah.
All right. Thanks. Since the future is a little uncertain and open, I wanted to actually go back to the past and get some grounding on the past, because that may be useful for us. And at least considering the cosmology of our own universe, the one universe we know of, we have been incredibly successful in building a history that, if you're really conservative, starts at about a hundredth of a second after the Big Bang, which is when the first nuclei were made, all the way to recombination, etc. So we have that, and that was achieved using certain laws that we can enumerate, and our list is going to not agree, but there are certain laws that we certainly will agree with. So the question that I have is, clearly within this pretty much 13.7 billion years, the laws that we know of have functioned, and they don't seem to have changed. So what I wanted to understand is, if you have a notion of when is it that these laws would change in time. So that's my first point. The second point is the following, is that if you now move run the moving forward, right, and you start with a simple-ish universe with the superparticles that combine and complexify and create new structures, those new structures are going to need new laws. So there are some new laws that you need as universe evolve, because universe becomes more complex. So for example, you know, to understand evolution, right, you need some new law that you did not need when the universe was perhaps a fraction of a second old. So, but that is not, I guess, the same thing that you're saying, that the law is changing time. So there are two different things, right? As things happen, you need new laws, or is it that the law is changing time, or are these two separate things?
So I'll try and then reverse it. So first question, past and then the future. Okay. So certainly we know that what's at stake is the issue of whether the initial singularity was real and was, quote, the first moment of time, or was some kind of transition from a previous state. Okay. In the literature, in all the contemporary cosmology, there are two kinds of answers to these questions. There are questions that involve eliminating the initial singularity and going prior to it, so attempts to seek an explanation in terms of succession, in terms of further history. Okay. And in all these different contexts, as you know very well, you know, and this is starting with Johnny Wheeler's speculations in the late 50s, early 60s, the notion that the laws might have been different before the Big Bang, the idea that the reprocessing of the universe, the changing of the laws, in quote the Big Bang, it is an idea which has been around in different forms, and we're certainly happy about that and interested to see how much science can be done. Because remember, we're still trying to do science. The idea is to make science and physics more explanatory, not less,
right,
by adding the hypothesis that the laws might have evolved in a way which leads to explication of these questions, not for.
But don't you worry that if you do that, you may fall into sort of an infinite regression?
Yes, yes, we do. And the way that we discuss this with
you, you do follow, or you do worry.
we do worry, and we say, and basically we say that this is what we call the issue of the meta laws. Is there, quote, laws which govern the change of laws? Okay, and how much empirical content might there be, because we want to keep doing science, that is, would it be possible to have verification of hypotheses about how those mental laws acted? And there are some hypotheses under which the answer is yes, and some hypotheses under which the answer is no. The other parts of the cosmological literature, which are not interested in pushing before the Big Bang, push outward to plurality, that is, to trying to find new methodologies to answer these questions in terms of ensembles of the universe. And our hunch is that that's not true, first of all. We don't believe first of all, this is about what's true and what's not true, and our hunch is that that's not true. And further, that it's a degradation of science. So that's, okay. And I don't want to minimize the difficulty of the issues involved. The issues involved are at best puzzling.
Okay, substantial.
Okay. Okay. As far as the second issue, I find helpful to think about the following question. This sort of comes from Stu Kaufman. I think that this goes in the direction of the resonant question. Okay. There certainly is downward causation. That is, for example, if you ask a question like, here's a question about molecular physics. Okay. Let's go 100 million years into the future. Give the list of proteins which will be in the biosphere of the Earth 100 million years in the future. That's a question about molecular physics. You might think it's a question that could be solved just by, quote, integrating the Schrodinger equation 100 million years in the future. Nonetheless, it's very clear that the answer, okay, the explanation for why certain proteins will be in the biosphere and other proteins will not be, will have to do with which species survived, which species had selective advantage, which species didn't survive, and which species didn't have selective advantage, some of which is predictive and some of which is stochastic. I certainly don't deny reductionism. Reductionism, the idea that you can explain features of complex systems by understanding something about their parts, use good common sense, but sometimes, as you know very well, explanation has to go the other way. Okay. Because one can ask questions about molecular physics that require, quote, a knowledge of how the higher order will evolve. So if there are higher order laws which only come into being, say, for example, laws of sexual selection or laws, God forbid, group selection, and come into being only when there are sexes and groups, then those laws somehow influence properties of molecules.
I mean, it influence properties of molecules.
Well, the property of molecules is which molecules are present in the biosphere. That is property.
We have a whole bunch of questions, so we'll see if we can keep moving. I'm willing to go a little bit over past 4:30 if that's okay, but not too long. Let's try to be concise. I think David was next.
Yeah, I have a question about the notion that the past is real and the future is not. We can't go back into the past and test if our recollection of it was correct. In a certain, I would say, tautological sense, memory is retrodiction, just like prediction. Statistical inference about something, and you can know more. In fact, in certain senses, you can test your predictions about the future far better than you can test your predictions about the past, modulo closed timeline curves. So I'm just wondering, what do you envision as the empirical content of the statement that the past is more real than the future?
I don't believe that. I believe the future is just as real as the past.
We disagree. But let me mention one thing with our chairman, with which for me is empirical content. I think it's possible to take the view that the time symmetry of Maxwell's equations is an interesting mathematical property, but that in nature only the retarded solutions actually occur and the advanced solutions never occur. There's only the solutions where waves spread out actually occur in nature, and never the solutions where waves converge. And that just because the Maxwell's equations have the property of time reversibility doesn't mean that nature has the property of time reversibility.
My view is slightly different, but that seems related.
I don't have to own that. That's my interpretation of your last paper.
Well, actually, it's something somewhat related, and then I'll go on that. That was the question that I asked earlier. Because it might be that we're hearing two different talks commingled here with two different viewpoints.
Well, to some extent, to some small extent, you are, but I think that's important.
But if Roberto says no and Lee says yes, then do I understand that there was a statement being made by either party that that as the universe unfolds, as opposed to evolves, which has connotations of either stochastic or deterministic dynamics, that somehow it is irredeemably not describable by mathematics, that there's some reason why I could not imagine just forming a infinite list of all events across all space-time, and there might be some nice patterns amongst them. We privilege those by calling them laws, but we don't need to. You could just imagine, so to speak, chaos, noise, where you just have a huge infinite set of events. They're described in some mathematical language, some logic, and that's it. And so math in that topological sense does describe everything, or are you envisioning that in some sense reality might extend even beyond that?
So what I meant by the claim that mathematics is quasi-empirical is that it is about the world. It is about structured wholes and bundles of relations, abstracted from time and from phenomenal distinction, and all the more useful in the description of temporal events because of that abstraction. So the main line of evolution of mathematics is not direct abduction from the world, but indirect analogical extension, internal development. So the initial propositions as in Euclidean geometry, are informed by our perceptual experience. But then the main line of evolution of mathematics is internal, through this analogical development. Then the creations of this analogical extension can or not be applicable to the world. What is mistaken is to suppose that mathematics represents a prophetic shortcut, an anti-vision of the intimate nature of reality. It doesn't.
But I don't think that answers my question. Would an extensive, would an infinite list, I'm not talking about underlying diffeomorphic cubes or something that they describe patterns, just an infinite list of events in some very abstract mathematical language, which in a certain very real sense has a future just as concrete as the present or the past, and has nothing to do with anything that science has learned or any other kind of sociological phenomenon. Is that something that you think could even be insufficient as a description of reality? It could be some kind of aspect of reality that's more.
Absolutely, it seems to me. It seems to me to be, if I understand correctly, maybe I don't understand your hypothesis, but it seems implausible as an account of the nature of mathematical insight. Mathematical insight evolves; we have it as part of our human faculties, an embodied organism. It extends our problem-solving powers. But there's absolutely no guarantee of a pre-established harmony between our mathematical insight and the constitution of the natural world. So our mathematical inventions could or not apply, or some of the world might be outside of them, and many of our inventions might not be useful in the analysis of the actual world.
Okay, I think we need to keep moving. A few more questions. Janine, you had some?
I did. I think this might be more of a question for Lini, and it's a genuinely exploratory question to get a better sense of what you mean by the status of the openness of the future, and in particular, to question to probe a little bit the relationship between determinism and the openness of the future. So I'm going to describe a little virtual universe that we can create, so we know all of the ingredients that go into it. So imagine sort of two chess computers, two chess agents, and they're roped together by some supervisory program so that they're playing against one another. And the way that the programs work is that there's a sort of random number generator that starts each of the computers off in one of an internally stored sort of repertoire of initial strategies. And they're very sophisticated. So they're basically like us. They observe each other's moves and they respond to one another moves, and they're sort of programmed to do so, but they also, they learn from one another over the course of time, they store information about past moves, and they use that information to try to guess at one another's delivery processes, and so on. So it's kind of geared to reproduce our own epistemic perspective when we're kind of engaged in kind of combat with one another in a kind of public realm. The whole system is deterministic. But from the point of view of each of the chess agents, they're sort of deliberating about how to act, and the future, their own actions are, in the course of deliberation, something that's in a literal sense yet to be decided by how they act, and no past information they could have is in any sense sort of probative or trumps the deliberative process. So what I want to know is, what do you say about their perspective? Do you think that from the point of view of the chess agents, the future is open? Do you think that they have any greater reason to believe that the future is open than we do? Do you think they're deluded if they think that the future is open? So part of what I'm curious about is your own motivation for saying that the future is open. Is it just to preserve those features of our own experience that are shared by the chess agents in this virtual universe, or is it something else?
So there's a whole realm I think I don't want to touch, which Roberto took possession of, if
about the implications of this for the view of humanity, for the view of society, and so forth. An implication of the last discussion about, let me not start there. My own motivations are these issues, okay, and the observation that proposals for cosmological scenarios that offer explanations, genuine explanations which are genuinely confirmable or falsifiable for some of these questions involve the evolution of laws. That is, and one of them is the cosmological natural selection idea that I played with, but there are others. The observation that by making the laws subject to evolution, we increase the cost of the potential explanatory power. Okay. So that's where I started on this. Now, I don't know the answer to the Medawar conundrum. The Medawar conundrum is if the evolution of, so having seen a virtue for allowing laws to evolve, one then faces that conundrum. Okay, if there is a theory or a law that guides the evolution of laws, which is of that same type, we're thrown back in the same stew. That is, what were the initial conditions? Why these laws? Why these initial conditions, etc. It might be that there is a root out of that in the form of a different kind of law, which doesn't have that structure. But it seems to me that, given the possibility of the genuine non-law-like character of the evolution of laws in the past, one has to allow it in the future. It would be too much special pleading to assume that such an important feature of the world only happened once when it was needed and was not inevitably a part of nature. So that's one thing. Another thing is the breaking, you know, I started my remarks by saying by making implicitly, and Roberta then made it much more explicit, three things are intimately related. One's understanding of the nature of law, one's understanding of the nature of time, that is time fundamental or emergent, and one's understanding of the role of mathematics in physics. And also possibly, but it's really outside the discussion of mathematics, it's somehow itself. And once one takes the view that time could be real in the sense that it precedes laws rather than evolves, rather than is a feature determined from or emergent from laws, then, just to tie the discussion with David, then the need to believe that there is a mathematical object which is isomorphic to the history of the universe just evaporates. There's a metaphysical need to believe that, which many feel, it underlies many kinds of speculations about cosmology, contemporarily and into the deep past. But once one adopts this point of view, it evaporates. One only needs mathematics in the role that it served to be useful for, which is basically that is to organize the records of past observations of subsystems of the universe. One doesn't need to believe that there's some transcendent relationship between the really real of the world and mathematics. And that leaves open the future.
Yes, I just want to add one point to that that has general applicability to much of our discussion. It is important not to conflate the idea that nothing is outside of time, including the laws of nature, with the idea that the future is open in any sense familiar to us in our human experience. I doubt that we know enough about the world to know whether the future of the universe is or is not open in any familiar sense. That was not the point of the argument that I presented. Otherwise, it would be a feel-good metaphysic. The point was to present a view of the situation and of the meaning of the discoveries of contemporary science, shorn of the gloss of metaphysical prejudice, including the extrapolation of the Newtonian paradigm, the premise of the existence of a timeless framework of natural laws, and the idea that the analysis of structure is more fundamental than the understanding of history. None of those suppositions are justified by what we have discovered about the world. They arise from the history of ideas, and they represent a conspiracy of metaphysical prejudice against the revolutionary progress of modern science. And what I have done, what we're trying to do together, is to separate one from the other.
Yeah, I think we have time for one more question, and then we can talk informally over drinks before dinner. All these...
mine's a relatively quick and trivial one by comparison with the weighty issues. Well, in the idea of laws changing with time, would you entertain something like the change in the fine structure constant that some people are claiming as an example of that? That's that over a more extended period, but not a change by very much. Is that sort of within the framework of what you're having?
Could be that, but
that's
but
also a change that could be created in a different
way. Yeah, so
that's
right.
But well, that's the meta law issue.
Yeah,
but Paul, your proposition 12 here on the board is another statement of the suggestion that the transformation of the laws can be coeval with the transformation of the phenomena.
Okay, good. Shall we thank our speakers again? Thank you.